days in. Joe Biden's speech, very much like a State of the Union, setting the upcoming agenda for his administration. Ed Blakely is a former Washington insider now living in Sydney, Australia. My name is Sean Britton from the radio station 2SER. Find us wherever you find good podcasts, week after week, at US of Ed. And make sure you check out the new podcast, Pacific Conversations, website edtalks.com.au. Big news this week, or we've got a big episode this week. Joe Biden's first 100 days in office. Successful, it would seem, on turning back the Trump agenda on COVID vaccines and for setting his own agenda for the coming 4 years. Ed, first thoughts.
It was one heck of a speech. I like three things about it. One, he used his voice very well. You could feel when he was going up and there's anger or excitement or a promise. The second thing I liked, there was content. It was not content-free like you hear so many presidential speeches. It says, we're going to do this, when we're going to do it, how we're going to do it. And third, I think, was the kitchen sink. Everything was there that he's promised. Not just with another promise, but a course of action. In some cases, he's going to do it, another executive order. But in many cases, he's asking for separate legislation. The Families Act, of course, is going to be his mainstay. He has two more programs that he can send up that only require a majority vote. And this is going to be one of them. But it covers a lot of things. So I don't know what's left out to cover anymore. It covers health care. It covers child care. It covers the $15 an hour. It covers new jobs and new sectors, training, and the like. The only thing it didn't cover was forgiveness of student debt. And he didn't cover immigration. He wants a separate bill on that. But he certainly said, this is my agenda for my administration for the next 4 years. Like it, leave it, but don't turn your back on it.
Yeah, I think we're going to be covering some more bits and pieces across this speech, given the issues of the week. Look, I want to point out something Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said this week, that Biden is exceeding progressives' expectations, which in my experience is pretty high praise from anyone on the left side of politics. Another source said that Biden has under-promised and over-delivered, at least under-promising when it came to the election campaign itself. And now, the 100 days in, he's kind of felt free to cut loose a little bit, I think, on the promises of the coming 4 years, of the Biden agenda, such as it were. Now, Biden is a moderate. He presented himself during the campaign as a moderate, but now I think in the speech today, he's a lot more progressive than a lot of us expected. Is it down to circumstance or a general leftward trend in politics?
No, I think he's reading the polls. Americans want more from government now, like the Roosevelt era. The idea that government's bad, evil, and will do harm has gone away pretty much. And this has to do with rising education levels. It also has to do with rising expectation levels. Television, cable TV in particular, has given the Americans a taste of what the rest of the world is all about. Places like Australia, where people now know there's a healthcare program. And Australians even speak English, just like Americans do. And that COVID and things like this can be beat, as Australia has done. So I think the American people, you could call it drifting left, I'd call it drifting to the middle, because there's nothing in this agenda that every European country doesn't have already. I can't think of exceptions, maybe Poland and Russia, but all the things that are promised are already in play in most of the Western world and China.
Yeah, I guess we got to we take for granted a little bit just how rightward American politics is from a standing point.
That's right.
Biden wanted to send this message that America's back with the speech that he made today. And I think that follows on from the climate summit this week, which was attended by 40 world leaders, attempt to get countries back on the same page when it comes to climate action. Biden was clearly there as well to send a message that America's back when it comes to global leadership, to moral leadership. Do you think he's succeeding?
He said, America is back. How long will we be back? And we will never be back alone. The notion that the United States can be the sole actor to fight for climate change, to deal with immigration, famine, wars, those days are over. America can be the leader at the table, but the table has to be full of willing participants. He took a lot of time talking about President Xi and his two-hour conversation with him, basically saying the agreement is now to compete. You guys are not a second-tier country anymore. You're first tier. We're going to treat you like that. Play fair. We will play fair. The field of competition is open, and we're going to play to win, but we will not attack. I thought that was a very good message. I think it's a message maybe the Australians could learn.
Yeah, Scott Morrison, our own glorious leader, left on mute, and I think somebody opined that that was a pretty good metaphor for Australia's contribution to the climate action debate at the moment.
Yes.
Look, I just wanted to sort of take a sideline on climate action for a moment. Biden certainly cut a fine figure in the speech today and cut a fine figure at the climate summit. But I think the real question is how this is going to translate into domestic politics, because the 50% reduction, this whole of government approach to climate change or combating climate change, Joe has to prove, I guess, that he can tackle the opposition and not just talk the talk.
Well, in this case, the American fleet of vehicles, the government fleets, have to be revitalized anyway. The Navy has been working, since I was in the United States, of moving all of their ships and military machinery into electric or co-dependent. And the reason for that is when you're out the open ocean, carrying fuel around is not a good idea. And you can't put atomic energy in every one of your ships. So you have to depend on solar, batteries, and the like. So the Navy has led the charge. The Army's picking it up. And I think the American military, in fact, are creating, through DARPA, as he mentioned, a lot of the techniques and technologies that will lead the nation into a new path of less fuel burden industrial production.
And I just also want to point out this, it's a slightly ludicrous story this week, but Republicans and Fox News pushed this kind of outrageous claim that Biden's climate plan would involve cutting 90% of red meat consumption from Americans' diets. You'd be limited to one good old-fashioned American cheeseburger per month in an effort to reduce greenhouse gases. Now, this is patent nonsense, you know, wouldn't usually necessarily justify it with discussion, but it is based on real scientific thought. And I think it just comes back to this key issue around climate action. Everyone wants to see it happen. Nobody wants to pay for it.
Oh, I don't believe that. I think the American farmers are willing to be involved in it. And Joe mentioned that farmers can be involved with carbon capture, selling some of their crops like corn and so forth to be turned into clean fuel and the like. I don't think people are into not paying for it, but I think people want to see how they can win from it. So I think that argument about that Trump was pushing that this is going to hurt people in the coal industry and so on is not just bogus, but Now the Coal Miners Association are saying, as they are here, we can produce some clean coal and use coal for the production of other things. And decarbonize the products that we produce, or produce new products. Even the notion of producing some portions of battery storage and so forth with coal, not a dumb idea. So I think now people are getting on the new wagon. Hey, my great-grandfather would not get in a car because he thought it wouldn't last. This is a technology that just won't go anywhere. So I think finally the world is figuring out that you can go someplace with new technologies. And he wants to lead with that notion, not that the United States will do everything. And by the way, if you looked at American waistline, 1 pound of meat a month is really enough.
Probably couldn't hurt. Also wanted to point out in the speech, Biden made this statement around the taxation of higher earners, higher earning Americans, that was obviously cut during the Trump era, saying that he wanted high earners to pay their fair share, not punish them necessarily. Now, besides raising taxes on those earning more than, what is it, $400,000 a year, Biden's looking to beef up the IRS when it comes to audits of high earners who might be avoiding tax, looking to spend $80 billion in the process. Ed, that's a lot of money. Is it going to pay for itself in the long run?
This is what I call shock and awe. The IRS only has to get two or three people, then everybody else will comply. This is not a hard thing to do. And when they brought in a lot of the other tax measures that caused a little bit of pain, people tried to cheat a little bit. That lasted about 15 minutes, and then everybody got on the team. Because going to Folsom, Sing Sing, and places like that, your accountants don't like it. They'd rather pay.
And just before we move on, still on today's, you know, first 100-day speech, just looking towards the end of it, and Biden had this rather interesting spot after he talked about addressing some of the threats that America is facing on a global scale, pointing out the threat of white supremacy as a domestic terror threat in America as well, and had this sort of very emotional moment talking about the daughter of George Floyd and saying George Floyd had essentially changed the world. Now, this also was followed up with a call for Republicans to join Democrats on issues such as gun control. What did you make of it, Ed?
This was the soft part, but the feely part. There is a bill now before Congress. I don't know if they're calling it the Floyd bill, but it's the one that prevents certain kinds of police tactics and the like. And fortunately, there's a black senator for South Carolina who's leading a coalition of senators on both sides to get that bill passed. I think it will pass. The only real sticky point is to what extent you can hold policemen responsible for acts of bringing people into custody and harming them in the process. I think they'll work it out. But at this point, while Floyd is fresh and the other recent killings are fresh, Americans have had enough. So I think a bill of this type will get through. And George Floyd's memory will be an annual event, much like the assassination here in Australia is being celebrated today.
In other news this week, Joe Biden has taken the step of acknowledging the Armenian genocide. Now, this genocide, of course, took place in the early 1900s during
1920.
During the World War One, surrounding World War One. where around 1 million Armenians were killed by the Ottoman Empire. But it hasn't been recognised in the States until now. What does this acknowledgement mean, Ed?
It means a couple of things here, and this is a very tricky issue. The reason the United States didn't want to acknowledge it was Turkey is an important strategic ally. The advanced missile bases in the eastern part of Turkey are a very important part of the American defense system. And Erdogan keeps saying, you mess with us and we'll throw you out. Erdogan is now, if you read some of the news, under enormous pressure at home. So the United States did what it had to do with the number of Armenians in the Congress and with the Armenians playing such a vital role in the American economy. Recognize this act, but it's carefully worded to recognize, not to say the Turks are guilty, but an act was committed, it doesn't say by the Turks.
And in some world news this week, Russia, a situation we've been talking about surrounding opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Mass unrest has led to some 13,000 arrests over the course of this year. Navalny himself, of course, imprisoned after that oh-so-mysterious poisoning incident. Now looking at a terrorist designation being put in place for the FBK, Navalny's anti-corruption organization. Who says the Soviet Union ever ended, Ed?
This is an interesting thing. We've been talking about the last 3 weeks at least. The number of Russians in the middle class who are discontented is increasing to the point that's destabilizing. It's the exact reflection in the mirror of the United States under Trump, where the lower middle class in the United States was disaffected and ended up storming the Capitol. He's in that position, Putin, that he has lost the confidence of the middle class. And surely the army can keep him in, but for how long?
In the UK, and I think this still remains relevant to how America has handled COVID-19, Boris Johnson has denied allegations. He said he would rather let the bodies pile up in thousands than have a second lockdown. If you follow much UK news, some industries are reeling at the fallout of Brexit. So the economy is on a knife edge as it is. And at some point, leaders, I guess, have to pick what to prioritise, lives or livelihoods. And I guess livelihoods in this sense can be the money of their biggest donors. Any thoughts, Ed?
Well, I think, again, we've been talking about this for some time through the entire Brexit crisis and pointing out, both of us, that Brexit puts England in a very difficult position because the United States does not trade with England that much, not enough to support their entire economy. England is looking for partners, and Australia is right now working out a treaty with England. But England's best customers are in the service industries, and those services, accounting and so forth, don't stretch to Australia or the United States. But you'd rather have an English accounting firm doing your business in Czechoslovakia than, I won't fill in the name of other accounting firms, some very rigorous and some very lax. So the English have lost their economic base. They don't make anything anymore, except the engines, the Rolls-Royce engines. And I'm not sure that they're the entirely biggest investor there. So they don't have very many REITs to fall on. Moreover, COVID has hit them very, very hard. Even though they've done a mass evacuation program, much like some states in the United States, it's still out of hand. The question for Boris is, he has no time. He has no new strategy. He has no new places to go, and waiting it out isn't good enough. He really needs to do what Biden's just done. He needs his family act. He needs his new jobs act and the like. And how they can create those deficits without the EEU to back up the bills is not clear to me.
And as a horrifying reminder that in some parts of the world, the coronavirus pandemic is well and truly not yet under control, cases in India have absolutely exploded this week. I mean, this isn't a second wave. This is
over 300,000 a day.
Absolutely.
And that's underreporting.
This is a tsunami of cases. This is a tidal wave of cases. Ed, where do they even begin starting on repairing something like this?
This is hard. And the reason for that is we say India, but India isn't one country. And it's like not like the United States where there's some shallow recognition of the other guys. Each of the provinces in India has its own systems of the way they do business. And some of them even have people who are Hindus and some Muslims and the like, and some mixtures of other sects. So when you don't have an organized national system, but one that spent most of its time dealing with the fact that they had neighbors who were bad guys and they were underprivileged and needed a lot of help and got it from the rest of the world, it's very difficult when you have a crisis like this and the rest of the world's in crisis. If India were in crisis alone, that'd be one thing. But as you know, even Australia is limiting flights from India. And the Australian-Indian Consul General said that was a good idea not to let Indian Australians back into the country until we can do it safely. So India really is a leper in the old sense. And leprosy, was the only way you could deal with leprosy was to isolate it. So I think India is going to have to be isolated, quarantined for a couple of years before this is stamped down. It's not going to go away by itself, as Trump suggests. Now, India has one thing on its side. They have the capacity to produce the pharmaceuticals in India. The only problem is, and I fear this, that there might be some knockoff pharmaceuticals being produced there because the government can't supervise. Right now, many of the pharmaceuticals we take here in Australia, the APOs, which are knockoffs, are done in India. India can't do drugs for Australia and drugs for India at the same time.
And just finally, circling back to domestic politics, such as it were, we mostly sort of ignore the fallout from Donald Trump and the kind of circus he surrounded himself with. But look, interesting news this week: authorities have raided the Manhattan apartment of former Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani amid the investigation into his dealings in the Ukraine. This is sort of the highest profile action taken as part of that investigation. Giuliani, I don't think, has responded to this one yet, although his son, Andrew Giuliani, called the justice action extremely disturbing and claimed it represented the continued politicization of the Justice Department, which is perhaps a little bit rich. Any thoughts on this one, Ed?
He's in the soup. They don't do these raids unless they already have the goods. And so I think that Giuliani, you can't put everyone who was a demonstrator January 6th, give them all 20 years, but you can certainly give Giuliani 20 years. And you do that, and that takes the wind out of a lot of sails. So I think Garland is taking that approach. I can't put 3,000 or 4,000 people in prison effectively. But if I put 2 or 3 in prison, and they are so high profile, I may able to get rid of these rats by killing the chief rat.
Ed and I will be back next week to discuss the latest in US news and politics. Subscribe so you don't miss a thing wherever you find the podcast, and check us out on Facebook and Twitter at US of Ed.